opinions expressed by callers, guests, and hosts do not necessarily reflect those of the Black Talk Radio Network and Black Talk Media Project. Black Talk Radio is new black media for the new millennium. Good evening and welcome to Black Talk Radio News. My name is Scotty Reed. I'm broadcasting from behind the enemy lines of USA Inc. It is a Saturday evening, just a little after 9 o'clock p.m. as we broadcast on this April the 8th, 2017. This is a news and information program. Callers are encouraged to participate if you would like to share your insights or commentary on any of the news that we are discussing or that I'm discussing. I'm acting like I got co-host or something on this program. The telephone number is 866-510-9025. That's 866-510-9025. Hit ** if you would like to comment on air. I really don't have a set time for this broadcast. Just we'll be on air to get through the news and take any calls that we may have. So today I want to, or tonight rather, I want to talk about Donald Trump's attack on Syria. Let me say this about that. I read a comment on social media where a person said, there's no black people living in Syria, so why should I care? Well, it seems to me that whether there's black people in Syria or not, if World War III breaks out, a lot of black people are going to be impacted by that. And Malcolm X talked about the maturity, especially the political maturity of black people, and to start viewing things through a world lens and not just our own little neighborhood or our community, because it's like a ripple effect. Something happens in one part of the world, you don't know how it can affect you. So if you're one of those people that don't care about what's going on in Syria or other parts of the world right now, because black people may not live there, you can tune out now. Okay, go ahead. All right, so, but we do want to talk about Trump's, what I feel like is a unconstitutional, law-breaking act of war against Syria. For those who may not know, I would assume pretty much everybody knows that pays attention to what Donald Trump is doing or to what the U.S. government is doing or politics, that you would know that Donald Trump launched about $60 million worth of cruise missiles, Tomahawk missiles, I should say, specifically at an air base inside of Syria, with the allegation or the justification that Syria used chemical weapons against some civilians. Now, I already put out a short video on this where I showed you how the news reports from 2 and 3 years ago, how the rebels were, the UN, when they did an inspection after the first chemical attack and said that the rebels did it. All right. And then I showed you the report from NPR, and you can Google that. But Assad gave up his weapons. I think that was in 2013, might have been in 2014, when he gave up his chemical weapons stockpiles. So, but that was the justification Donald Trump used. So we will talk about that. Related news, you had Representative Tulsi Gabbard, a Democrat representing Hawaii. She talked about the chemical attack with the fake news journalist Wolf Blitzer. I really don't like that man. And this goes back to his so-called reporting, really was editorializing on 9/11 and the run up to the war or the invasion, I should say, of Iraq. I really don't like Wolf Blitzer, but he got taken to task by Tulsi Gabbard. And I'm going to let y'all see that video because there's a lot you can learn from it. And you could just see how Wolf Blitzer is not an objective journalist, but he is a propaganda mouthpiece. And whatever the powers that be want them to push the American public towards, then that's what they're going to do. And so you had Representative Gabbard making some tweets on Twitter about the chemical attack. So they thought they would bring her on CNN. And she handled Wolf Blitzer quite well. So I do have that video. I'll pull that up for you. Now, here is something that I thought about today with everybody talking about the 70 so people who were killed in this particular attack in Syria, and Donald Trump talking about, oh, you know, the civilians, we got to look out for the civilians and we got to do something. And the United States just last week just killed about 300 people when they did an airstrike on a residential area inside of Mosul, Iraq. Mosul, however you pronounce that, in Iraq. So I'm like, oh, we just going to forget about those 300 and we just going to focus on these 70s. And like I said in my last video about that, do y'all really think the United States cares about civilians and who has killed more civilians, whether it's through the CIA drone program, whether it's the Iraq invasion of Iraq back when Bush was in there, all the civilians killed in Libya. Do you all really think that they care about these civilians? No, they don't. They don't. They don't even care about civilians in the United States with over 1,000 Americans being killed, shot dead in the street by cops every year. So don't fall for that. They don't care about those people. And certainly Donald Trump doesn't. In some police state news, I want to share with you an article from Cynthia Tucker. She says the Trump Justice Department is taking backward steps. And what she is talking about, the Attorney General, the new U.S. Attorney General, what's his name? Beauregard Sessions, Jeff Beauregard Sessions, and how he is sending, and I've done videos about this too. I did a broadcast where I talked about how more people, including cops, will be killed because Jeff Sessions is telling police departments all around the country that y'all can treat the people any kind of way you want to. You don't have to worry about us coming in, looking over your shoulder or investigating you for constitutional violations or anything of the sort. Just do your thing. We're not in the business of telling police how to do their jobs. Now, see, to me, that statement right there is grounds for impeachment. But, of course, he's not going to get impeached. He took an oath of office to uphold the Constitution and the laws. And the last time I checked, that also applies to police. They don't get a free pass, although they've been getting a free pass. But it, theoretically, they shouldn't get a free pass. They should be subject to the same laws that everybody else is subject to. And it's quite ridiculous, the things that he has been saying. And when I was taking a look at that particular article, I started thinking back to another video I did some months ago about the law enforcement being infiltrated by white supremacists, according to a 2006 FBI report. That was in 2006. Well, I was thinking about that, and I know in that report it was talking about how they had politicians who used to be in law enforcement but were now representatives or officials in the U.S. government, and saying that they had connections to white nationalist groups, white supremacist groups. And, I mean, it's really out the bag now with the Trump administration and all those ties to white nationalists. So I was thinking, I wonder if Jeff Sessions is one of those people. And, of course, they redacted the names, and they didn't share those names. But while I was thinking about that, I tried to pull that up. But I came across an article on The Intercept, and that's article said that the FBI had actually, I don't know if it's the FBI, we'll get to the story, but the FBI or the Justice Department was laying out policies and that they are continuing to investigate white supremacists who have infiltrated law enforcement. And really, if you take a long view of history, you know that law enforcement has always been rife with the Klan. And if they didn't have outright Klan members in the department, they certainly were siding with the Klan. And they have always been the enforcers of slavery, the black codes during Jim Crow, and all of the, I would say, nonviolent so-called codes where they just want the drug war is what I'm trying to say. All of that is a result of them. The United States does not get to have the world's largest prison slave labor population without police, okay? So definitely want to take a look at that Intercept article. It came out in January, but it kind of slipped past me, and I think it slipped past a whole lot of people as I had not seen it until now. Another thing I want to talk about is school choice. The Arizona governor just signed a law. Now, some people are saying that it's school vouchers, but I found an article on Examiner that says it's not really school vouchers that Arizona's going to allow parents to use to decide where they want their children educated at. But it is sort of like a education account, like a bank account just for education. Seems like when I was working in the corporate world, I remember some insurance and we had flex accounts that you could set up for medical emergencies and things of that nature. So it kind of reminded me of that. So I definitely want to take a look at that article. I definitely have mixed feelings about so-called school choice. When I think about the term school to prison pipeline, when I look at how little black boys and girls are discriminated against in these schools and are suspended at far higher disproportionate rates than their counterparts. And like we were looking at the law in Missouri where now a five-year-old can be charged with a felony for having a school fight. So I'm like, why would anybody want to send their children to these public schools? Now, I have a sister who's a public school teacher. My cousin who lives next door, he's a school teacher. I got another cousin in Detroit. She's I think she's teaching at the college level, though. But I know a number of teachers. Many of you probably are teachers. So I understand your apprehension about these sort of bills and all the money being drained away from public school funding. But that was happening already anyway. That was already happening as schools continue to close across the country. So if that's the case, I would say I would be open to these school vouchers or education accounts. And I wish I had been more conscious when my daughters were in school, and I possibly would have homeschooled them. Well, I would have homeschooled them if I knew back then what I know today, all right? And now I'm not trying to say that all schools are bad and all schools are terrible. I'm not trying to paint the entire public school system with a broad brush like that. But I'm just saying we, over the years, have reported on a number of stories connected to the school to prison pipeline and all the things I've already mentioned. So again, if you have any thoughts that you would like to share, any insights on any other articles that I'm going to go over during this broadcast, don't hesitate. Give us a call at 866-510-9025. Now, I do have some updates that I would like to share. Just give me a second as I get everything set up here. As we had been having some problems with some of our streams, so I'm just trying to make sure everything's going. All right, yeah. Okay, everything looks good there. All right, so want to go over a couple of these updates for political prisoners, U.S. held political prisoners, before I get into some of the news stories. Let's go ahead and pull up this one. This comes to you from New York City Jericho Movement. It is concerning political prisoner Seth Hayes, who is a Black Panther. NYC Jericho received a phone call from Seth on Wednesday, April the 5th, 2017. He called to inform us that they're talking about the Department of Corrections, and I believe he is being held as a political prisoner in the New York State prisons. But he called to inform us that the DOCCS is finally beginning to train him and Sullivan medical staff in the use of the insulin pump monitor. He would have begun training today, but the individual had only brought the pump, not the monitor. So training has been delayed until later this week or early next week when the entire apparatus will be present. Seth wants to thank everyone who made phone calls, faxed, and wrote on his behalf. He says this shows the power of the people. Thank you for your time and effort. It has and continues to make a difference. And this has been posted to our political prisoner radio page if you want to go ahead and get his address and write to him. But he has been suffering medical issues, as you might have gathered from that. And, you know, it just took a long time for them to attend to his medical needs. And if it was not for the campaign to write and fax and call these people, then it would not have happened. And you can believe that. All right, I have another update for you. Let's go ahead and pull that one up. As you may know, I believe I put a video out last week or earlier this week focusing on political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal, who has the Hep C virus, and he has been going untreated for a number of years. Now, Hep C is actually an epidemic in the U.S. prison system. You have a lot of people who are being exposed to the Hep C virus. Now, there is a cure for it. It's very expensive, but there is a cure for it. And Mumia has been fighting through the courts, of course, with help from a number of advocates for him to gain access to this treatment. It's an antiviral treatment for his Hep C, which can cure it. But he's not only fighting for himself, but it could, as we have reported, open it up so that all these other prisoners can get treated for Hep C. Again, I don't understand why the CDC isn't reporting on this or declaring a national health emergency or what have you. But again, that's just another sign that they're practicing slavery. They don't care. This is 21st century slavery and human trafficking. So I do want to share this audio from Prison Radio. Shout out to Noelle Hammerhand, big fan of the work. We're going to have to get her back on the program. But check out prisonradio.org, where they publish a lot of the audio from phone calls from prisoners, political prisoners. So let's go ahead and give a quick listen to an update from Mumia Abu-Jamal. Oh, by the way, he has begun his treatment.
The beginning. It has begun. Today marked the second day since I began the treatment regimen of direct-acting antiviral drugs, or DAADs, designed to eliminate hepatitis C from my system. You, the people, made this possible. You, the people, filled two courtrooms in Scranton in December 2015. You, the people, supported our lawyers, Brett Grody of Abolitionist Law Center of Pittsburgh, and Bob Boyle of New York City, as well as Dr. Joseph Harris, M.D., who diagnosed me as I was nodding in and out in a wheelchair in a prison visiting room, and later served as an expert witness in our hearings in Scranton. You, the people, sent love, prayers, letters, cards, money, and strength to us all, for which the words, "I thank you," seem pale in comparison. Yet I thank you still. You, the people, are helping me heal. The battle isn't over, But this is a damn good beginning. From Imprison Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
And so that was the update on Mumia. Thankfully, he has begun his antiviral treatment for Hep C. Again, this is why it is very important for us to stay abreast of what's happening with our political prisoners, because many of the activists today could become be your political prisoners of tomorrow. Now, I do have another update from Jericho. They're asking people to pack the court on Monday, April the 24th, to win the freedom for Mumia Abu-Jamal. Let me just quickly pull up that information so that I can read it to those who can't see it because they're listening on the radio station. So here are the details. This is also posted to our political prisoner radio page on Facebook. So Monday, April the 24th, pack the court to win freedom for Mumia Abu-Jamal from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. There'll be a rally at the Criminal Justice Center at 1303 Filbert Street in Philadelphia. So all our people in Philadelphia and surrounding areas, you are invited. From 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. will be the actual court hearing. Supporters will take turns witnessing the court proceedings as the rally continues outside. Mumia is innocent and was framed. 35 years in prison is 35 years too long. On April 24th, Mumia Abu-Jamal's birthday, there will be a court hearing on his PCRA, Post-Conviction Relief Act, petition in Pennsylvania courts. This is an action to overturn all of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court decisions from 1995 to 2008 that denied him freedom despite the evidence that the police and prosecution manufactured the proof of his guilt and suppressed evidence of his innocence. This latest legal challenge is based on the recent U.S. Supreme Court decision in the Williams case, which ruled that an appellate judge cannot participate in a case in which he formerly had a personal role in a significant prosecutorial decision. Ronald Castillo was the district attorney responsible for opposing Mumia's 1989 appeal of his trial conviction and death sentence. Then, after being elected to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court in 1994, Castillo ruled against Mumia in every appeal brought before him, critical of the actions of his former DA's office. Castillo ran for election to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, bragging that 45 men, including Abu-Jamal, were sentenced to death by his DA's office and that he was financed by and had been honored by the FOP, that's the Fraternal Order of Police, which, by the way, not too long ago, had a little meeting with Donald Trump as man of the year. We called for Mumia's immediate release from prison. And as they say, free them all. Free them all. Free Mumia, free all political prisoners and prisoners of war. Okay, so that's it for our announcements. Let's go ahead and jump into some of the news stories that I would like to share with you this evening. So this first story that I want to jump on is Donald Trump on, this comes from CNN, and it has some quotes from Donald Trump and what he said about why he attacked Syria, why he committed an act of war against a sovereign nation without a declaration of war from Congress, without a UN Security Council resolution. And we know Syria did not attack the United States. So it goes on to say, before launching a military strike on Syrian government target, President Donald Trump said Thursday that something should happen with regard to Syrian leader Bashar al-Assad in the wake of this week's chemical attack, which U.S. officials say he perpetrated. I think what Assad did is terrible. I think what happened in Syria is one of the truly egregious crimes. It shouldn't have happened. It shouldn't be allowed to happen, Trump told reporters aboard Air Force One. I think what happened in Syria is a disgrace to humanity. He's there, and I guess he's running things, so something should happen. So we have seen, and when I say we, I'm talking about the public, we have seen no evidence that the Syrian government was responsible for this chemical attack. As I stated at the beginning of the program, I did a short little 5-minute video, might have been 6 or 7 minute video, as I visited the issue and how I played the video from the UN inspector the last time there was a chemical weapons attack, and they blamed it on Assad. And the UN inspector said all the evidence pointed to the rebels. Was it the Saudi-backed rebels? Was it the Qatar-backed rebels? Was it the U.S.-backed rebels? Okay? And then also I shared an article from the U.K. I think it was The Guardian. No, it was the Mail Online, which is a U.K.-based paper, and how a British defense contractor, emails were leaked that showed that the defense contractor had a go-ahead approval from Washington, D.C. This would have been the Obama administration at the time to stage a chemical attack, well, to actually do a chemical attack using the rebels and then blaming it on Assad. All right, so these were all news articles published in major papers, not that I put any kind of faith just because they're major papers and that they're reporting the truth, but some people do. And those were those things I'm talking about were reported in those papers. Now, NPR actually did a report where Susan Rice was guaranteeing that they got rid of all Assad's chemical weapons. He allowed the UN to come in, inspect his stockpiles, and remove them. The United States even participated, because not only did they take his chemical weapons, but they took the machinery that was needed to create the chemical weapons. This all you got to do is use Google. It's all right there for you to see. So I'm like, you know, where is the proof? Because all I saw, what's her name, Nikki Haley, who's the Trump administration's ambassador to the UN. All she did was stand in front of the UN and give a bunch of hyperbole and show some pictures of some dead children. No different than Colin Powell showing some pictures of these so-called mobile chemical weapon factories or labs, which all turn out to be fake, okay? So, again, these people are very unoriginal. They use the same tactics over and over. But I guess they figure, hell, if it works, then we're going to keep using it till it stops working. So Nikki Haley standing in the UN showing all these little pictures of dead babies. Well, that's not proof. All that is proof that people died. And, yes, it has been determined by independent observers that from the autopsies that it was a chemical attack. I don't think anybody's disputing that. But what is it in dispute is who did it. And so Donald Trump, I don't know, maybe he saw the pictures and he was moved by his compassion for little dead children. He won't let them in the country, but you know, he's so concerned about these children who lost their lives due to this chemical attack. And so he gives warning to the Russians, who, of course, are going to warn their Syrian allies. And then he launches $60 million worth of Tomahawk missiles, which did very minimal damage to the airstrip, to the airport or the air base. And in less than 24 hours, they're launching sorties from it again. So, I mean, this is all rather ridiculous. But again, I will continue to maintain that this was an illegal act. This was an illegal act. And by the way, you know, heard of that website called PolitiFact.com? I was on there today, and they were raiding this U.S. representative. I think he was a Democrat. I can't remember his name. But he was saying that This is a violation of the Constitution. Congress was not consulted. They made no declaration of war. They didn't give a limited authorization for military action. And Syria did not take attack the United States. So Donald Trump was in violation of international law and the U.S. Constitution. So the PolitiFact article just name what Obama did. They even went back to Reagan, saying Reagan invaded Grenada without authorization from Congress, without any kind of resolution from the United Nations, and to overthrow a Marxist government. See, they love to use those labels to justify what they do, okay? And so, but I'm like, hell, that's not evidence. That's not evidence. Just because you had presidents in the past who have violated the Constitution as it relates to war powers and what have you, that's not evidence that Donald Trump did not violate the Constitution. That's not evidence. So, but then, so they're going to rate what that man said as false, as his pants being on fire. And this is why I tell y'all, just because Snopes says something is true or isn't true, or any of these so-called fact-checking websites, I don't even know who fact-checked the article. I don't know. They didn't have no name subscribed to it. So how do we know? But use your own due diligence. Use your own intelligence and look up the Constitution and see what it says about war powers. All right, do your own research on these issues. And just the other day, the Real News Network had on an international law professor where she laid out how all the different ways it was violating international law and violating U.S. law. So y'all just had to be careful. There is really a war going on between the independent media and the corporate media, all right, because they see that the independent media's influence is growing and they are attacking us because Hillary Clinton, they weren't able to shove Hillary Clinton down our throats, and people were reporting on, was there some fake news? Now, the Pizzagate stuff, I would say that was fake. All right, I say that was fake. But all the other stuff that she did, that wasn't fake whatsoever, but all this is a war of the corporate state media against independent media because they weren't able to brainwash enough people to vote for the crook Hillary Clinton, the war criminal Hillary Clinton. But anyway, let me move on. I didn't mean to go on that tangent, but it is a good segue into this next video that I want to play for you so you can hear it, and it's Representative Gabby, let me make sure I got her name correct. She is a Democrat out of Hawaii. Tulsi Gabbard is her name. And she was on CNN. They brought her on because she was tweeting about the Syria chemical attacks. And so I'm going to just go ahead and roll that for you. But watch, just pay attention to Wolf Blitzer. Now, he's supposed to be the objective journalist here. I don't even know if he has the title of a journalist. I don't know. I don't know if he's ever even went to school for journalism. I'm not saying you got to go to school to be a journalist. But just watch how he tries to manipulate her during the interview, tries to get a I gotcha moment from her, but she was totally prepared, and she handled him very very well. A lot of people could learn from how she handles Wolf Blitzer if you have an organization and you deal with the media. So let's go ahead and roll that clip. Okay, that's the wrong one.
Let's talk about this chemical attack. You tweeted about the attack, and I'll put it up on the screen. You tweeted this: whoever is found responsible, be it the Syrian government, Al-Qaeda, or ISIS, all have access to chemical weapons, must be held accountable. Who do you believe is responsible for that chemical attack that killed so many civilians, including so many children?
Here's the issue, Wolf, is what I believe, what you believe or others believe is irrelevant. What matters here is the evidence and the facts. If President Assad is found to be responsible after an independent investigation for these horrific chemical weapons attacks. I'll be the first one to denounce him, to call him a war criminal, and to call for his prosecution, the International Criminal Court. Make sure that those consequences are there. But the key is now with President Trump's reckless military strikes last night. It flew directly in the face of the action that the UN was working on at that time to launch an independent investigation, to find out exactly what the facts are, who was involved and who was responsible, so that the appropriate consequences could be levied.
So, Congresswoman, when the Pentagon says it was the Syrian regime of Bashar al-Assad who was responsible, when the Secretary of State says that, the President says that, they all conclude that they have the evidence to back it up. They say Assad did it, his military did it. You don't believe them necessarily.
Well, last time I checked, Wolf, Congress had the authority and the responsibility for declaring war, for authorizing the use of military force. So whether the President or the Pentagon or the Secretary of State says that they have the evidence, the fact remains that they have not brought that evidence before Congress. They have not brought that evidence before the American people. And they have not sought authorization from Congress to launch this military attack on another country. The fact is that the United States has been waging this war, this regime change war now for years, covertly through the CIA, to overthrow the Syrian government. The result of this has been the suffering of the Syrian people, hundreds of thousands of people dead, millions of refugees, and the strengthening of terrorist groups in Syria, like Al-Qaeda and ISIS, whose goal is to overthrow the Syrian government. So this escalation that President Trump took yesterday in launching this military attack continues this illegal, unconstitutional war.
So, Congresswoman, are you saying when General Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, or General McMaster, the President's National Security Advisor, come to the President and they say, here's the evidence, we now know for sure that the Syrian regime did this, here are the various military options to respond, and he gives the okay, you say you have doubts about these generals providing that kind of proof to the President?
Well, Wolf, I remind you about what happened before we launched an invasion and occupation of Iraq. Then Colin Powell and many others within the administration came to Congress and came to the UN claiming they had the evidence proving that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. We launched a completely destructive, counterproductive war based on that intelligence, which has now, years later, proven to be wrong. We had leaders in Congress then who questioned that evidence that was presented and voted against that war because they were not convinced by the administration then saying that they had the proof necessary to launch this war. So yes, I'm skeptical because we have to take at a premium the cost of these wars, not only on the Syrian people and the people in the Middle East, but the cost of these wars here in the United States at a time where, you know, we don't have money to build the roads that we need here in Hawaii or in other parts of the country. Why should we just blindly follow this escalation of a counterproductive regime change war, sending American taxpayer dollars on these failed regime change wars that we've seen too often in Iraq, in Libya, and now continuing in Syria?
Because the Pentagon says they have radar tracking that shows that Syrian regime planes were in the air at the time of this attack. They also say they have heat signatures showing that those planes dropped those chemical bombs in those areas where the civilians were exposed to that kind of nerve agent. But what I hear you saying is you don't necessarily buy that.
Well, once again, Wolf, all I'm saying is that we have an executive branch of government and a legislative branch of government, and we need to see the evidence. Congress and the American people need to see and analyze this evidence and then make a decision based on that whether or not an authorization of U.S. military force is necessary. And what I'm telling you is that that hasn't happened. I have not seen that independent investigation occur and that proof presented showing exactly what happened. And there are a number of theories that are out there on exactly what occurred that day.
You met with President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus this past January, just a little while ago. Do you doubt, Congresswoman, that he's capable of launching a chemical attack on his own citizens? Because the Obama administration said he did it back several times in 2013 until the Russians came in and said they would try to destroy all of his chemical weapons stockpiles.
Again, this isn't about what I believe or what I doubt. What matters the most here are the facts. The American people deserve to see and know of the evidence and the facts before authorizing the continuation of this destructive, counterproductive, illegal regime change war. Our interest, Wolf, must be on bringing about peace, that if we truly care and are compassionate for the Syrian people, these children and women and innocent people who are being most impacted by this war, we need to end this destructive regime change war, not escalate it as the president has just done through his illegal military strike launched last night.
Why did you meet, Congresswoman, with President Bashar al-Assad? You know, you got a lot of criticism for going to Damascus and meeting with him. Why did you decide to meet with him?
You know, I went to Syria in the interest of furthering the cause of peace, to see and hear firsthand from the Syrian people how we can bring about an end to this counterproductive regime change war, something that I have been fighting for now as a member of Congress for years. Whether we like it or not, President Assad remains the president of Syria. And in order to determine a negotiated outcome to end this regime change war that, again, has cost hundreds of thousands of lives and millions of refugees, he has a part to play in bringing about that negotiated outcome. We should not continue this counterproductive regime change war, overthrow the Syrian government, first and foremost, because it will be destructive to the Syrian people, just like we saw our wars in Iraq and Libya turned out to be worse off for the people of those countries. And just like in those two countries, we're already seeing this war we've been waging for years has only proven to strengthen these terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda and like ISIS, who are trying to overthrow the government so that they can walk in and fill that vacuum and take over all of Syria for their own nefarious means.
Who is responsible, Congresswoman, for the deaths of more than 400,000 Syrians, mostly civilians and a lot of children, elderly? Who do you blame for those deaths over the past 6 years?
There are a number of ways that you can point the finger, Wolf. I'm interested in finding the solution, and the solution is to end this counterproductive regime change war. The United States has been waging, along with allies, so-called allies like Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Turkey, all seeking to overthrow the Syrian government. We have been providing arms, funding, salary, support, intelligence, and other types of both direct and indirect support to armed militants within Syria who are working directly with Al-Qaeda, who are allied with terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda towards this end of overthrowing the Syrian government, all in action which has resulted in more chaos and suffering for the Syrian people, as well as counterproductive to our American national security interests by strengthening the very enemy that attacked us on 9/11. It makes no sense, and I've spoken to you before about my bill, the Stop Arming Terrorists bill, that would put an end to this madness by prohibiting American taxpayer dollars from paying for this support, for paying for this counterproductive regime change war.
But don't you believe that Bashar al-Assad bears a lot of the responsibility for the horrific deaths that have occurred in his own country, his regime, his military going out there and killing all these people? Don't you think, Congresswoman, he bears a lot of that responsibility?
There is responsibility that goes around, Wolf. Again, my interest is in bringing about peace. Standing here and pointing fingers does not accomplish peace for the Syrian people. It will not bring about an end to this war. That is my sole focus and my interest, both for the United States and for the Syrian people. And that's why it's so important, A, that we end this destructive, counterproductive regime change war, and that we work towards bringing about a peaceful negotiation where the Syrian people can determine their own future for themselves.
You met with the president. He was then the president-elect during the transition in New York, and then you went in January to meet with President Bashar al-Assad. Did you convey any message to Bashar al-Assad from President Trump during your meeting in Damascus?
No. And any reports suggesting otherwise are complete bogus and fake news.
What was Bashar al-Assad's message to you, Congresswoman?
He talked about what was happening in his country, his interest in defeating ISIS, and talked about how to bring about an end to this war.
Do you have any regrets about going? Because you faced a lot of criticism, as I pointed out, since then.
You know, Wolf, I've never made decisions based on fear of what might people think or what might be politically advantageous for me. As a veteran, I have seen the cost of these wars, experienced them firsthand, seen the human cost in friends of mine who did not come home from the war in Iraq. I went to Congress promising my constituents, my fellow veterans and brothers and sisters in uniform, that I would do all I could to prevent our country from making these kinds of disastrous and destructive mistakes again in the future. I went to Syria with the focus and mission on peace, how we can bring about an end to this destructive regime change war. And I'm continuing that fight today.
Here. No, I'm not a writer.
Okay.
Black Talk Radio, since 2008, providing new black media for the masses. And welcome back to Black Talk Radio News. Scotty Reed in for this broadcast from behind the enemy lines of USA Inc. So that was a pretty interesting exchange between Wolf Blitzer. Again, you know, one of those fake news propagandists that come on your TV nightly. Now, he did not seem like the journalist there, right? The journalist supposed to focus on getting the facts or what have you. That's not what he was doing. It seemed like he was trying to paint her into a corner or try to get her into a I gotcha moment. It seemed like Wolf, just like during the run-up to Iraq war, is pushing for the invasion of Syria. Okay, so they want to attack the alternative media or the independent media as being fake news. That was an example right there of the propaganda that you get from outlets like CNN. And I thought she did fairly well. She was well prepared, but basically you don't have to prepare when you have the truth on your side. You just tell the truth. You don't have to come up with talking points or anything like that. And she kept saying regime change, regime change. Now think about that. Right now they're talking about the Russians interfered in our elections. But the United States has overthrown country after country after country. All right. And she's telling the truth about the United States funding these terrorists. You know, it's just a breath of fresh air to hear a representative of the U.S. government representing Hawaii, as she does, tell the truth about it. Tell the truth that the United States has been arming and strengthening terrorists to overthrow these other countries. It happened in Libya. It happened in Iraq. And I mean, look at Libya now. Look at Libya now. Now, that Gaddafi was a U.S. ally. They signed an agreement with the United States during the Bush administration in 2005. His focus was on capturing and killing these Islamic extremist terrorists, all right? And he had locked a whole bunch of them up and what have you. And then he gave up his chemical weapons. Oh, by the way, fake news, I was watching CNN earlier today, and you had this man saying that Gaddafi had chemical weapons, and that's why we took him out. That was never, ever a charge by the Obama administration. All the Obama administration said was he was killing his own people, which was a lie, but they never mentioned anything about chemical weapons because he gave up his chemical weapons about a decade earlier. Okay, so again, a lot of fake news come off of CNN. So, but they're talking about the Russians interfere with the election. Basically, what they're saying is, if we hadn't found out that the DNC, and I'm saying we the people, had not found out that the DNC had rigged the primary, had rigged the process to favor Hillary Clinton, and if all these emails didn't come out showing what a corrupt, immoral bunch they are, then Donald Trump, then she would have won. So, you know, I mean, it's like, man, it's surreal. It's just very, very surreal. Oh, if y'all didn't know Hillary Clinton was a crook and the DNC had set it up to cheat everybody else, then she would have won. Darn those Russians. And again, no evidence shown that the Russians hacked the DNC servers. None of these intelligence agencies have actually examined the crime scene, which would be the servers. But we're supposed to believe that the Russians hacked those servers and then released those emails showing how crooked and corrupt the DNC was, you know. But then, never mind the fact that the United States, I don't know, hundreds of countries since World War II, almost 100, I don't know how many, I know it's over 100 countries that the United States has interfered in their elections or outright overthrown their governments. But people supposed to feel bad for the United States when you falsely accuse Russia of meddling in your elections? Again, what kind, we're dealing with sociopaths. These people, it's like, you know, they have no conscience whatsoever, and they just will point the finger at somebody else while they doing the same exact thing. And but we're supposed to, you know, ignore what they're doing. So that was very refreshing to hear Representative Gabbard on this issue of the Syrian invasion. Now, let me go ahead and check our conference line. Again, if you have any questions or comments during the broadcast, you can get on air by dialing 866-510-9025. That's 866-510-9025. Hit ** to unmute yourself. For those already who are listening on their phones in the conference line, just hit ** anytime you want to comment. I'll try to remember to keep checking the conference line. All right, so I want to move on to another semi-related story. Yeah, it's related. Now, just last week, the big news was the United States military conducted an airstrike inside of Iraq in Mosul, call itself taking out terrorists, but they bombed a residential area, which, by the way, happens to be in violation of the Geneva Conventions. Again, this is why I tell you, I don't care nothing about for those people who say we are a nation of law and order and you know, we need to obey the law. Well, these people need to lead by example. They don't even follow the law whatsoever. They don't follow the law. So you bombing civilian areas, residential areas, infrastructure, that's all in violation of the Geneva Conventions, which were signed by the United States and a whole bunch of other nations following World War II. So here it's right in our face. They admitting that they bombed this residential area and they killed all these people. But that's now, you know, all of a sudden, that's no longer news. Not on CNN, not on MSNBC, not ABC, not none of your alphabet networks. That's old news now, right? But just last week, they killed, and I say, when I say they, I'm talking about the United States military, just killed a whole bunch of civilians in Iraq. Now, let me ask you this. With China, with Russia, would any nation with submarine, nuclear submarine capabilities, would they be justified if they launched a nuclear weapon at Washington, D.C. and blew Washington, D.C. off the map? Or if they just launched a whole bunch of missiles of their own into the United States, citing what happened in Iraq as a grave crime against humanity? And they will actually have more proof than the United States has that Syria is behind the chemical attacks. The United States military is admitting that they killed all these people. All right. The only discrepancy is the number of people. So, I mean, would these sovereign nations, would these other nations be justified to attack the United States for what it's doing in Iraq or anywhere else in the world? Just launch some missiles just because, you know, the military did this or did that. So, you know, it's always good to put the shoe on the other foot. How would you feel if the international community came up with a UN resolution saying, oh, the United States military violated the Geneva Conventions. They committed grave war crimes. And so we're going to pass a resolution to authorize an attack on the United States. But yet we sit around, and I'm talking about some of us, not all of us, obviously, sit around and we cheer and we support the United States taking this sort of action like they some kind of moral authority. And I was reading on social media, somebody said, oh, the United States had to do something. We got to be the moral leader of the world. I'm like, dude, is you crazy? And this a black person, too. I'm like, dude, is you sick? How is this a moral country? This country has started more wars and killed more people than any other nation on the face of the planet since World War II. There seems to be a major war the United States gets itself involved in every 20 years in its 200-year existence. Might be a little over 200 years by now. What makes this a moral country? A country that locks up more of its citizens on prison plantations and hires them out to Fortune 500 companies, or the state uses their free labor? They have the largest prison slave labor force on the planet. Most of the people in there for nonviolent so-called drug offenses. And that's a moral country. That's a moral country that's still practicing legalized slavery via the 13th Amendment. That's a moral country. That's a moral country where the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, allows these terrestrial radio stations, the public airways, to play music in urban areas where the music is promoting murder, is promoting drug use, is promoting drug dealing, is promoting date rape, is promoting, I mean, all of this garbage. And the FCC ain't got a problem with it. This is a moral country. Please, please slap yourself for me, okay? Go ahead and just slap yourself. Because you sound pretty damn stupid. All right. So the next story I wanted to jump into was this 300 killed. This is from the Los Angeles Times. Nearly 300 died in Mosul airstrike, making it one of the deadliest attacks on civilians in recent memory. The United States did that. The United States did this. Where is the outrage? Why isn't anybody lining up to bomb Washington, D.C. for this attack on civilians? So it goes on to say Iraqi officials said Wednesday that they had removed nearly 300 bodies from the site of an apparent airstrike in West Mosul, the largest civilian death toll since the battle against the Islamic State began more than 2 years ago and among the deadliest incidents in decades of modern warfare. More bodies were being removed Wednesday as the U.S.-led coalition investigated whether it was responsible. Iraqi officials blame Islamic State and the injured continue to suffer. Now, listen to these proxy racist puppets of the U.S. government. Does the Islamic State fly airplanes? Do they have an air force? How would they conduct this airstrike? Iraqi officials, if they really said that. And the U.S. is investigating whether or not it did. It knows it did it. Let's stop playing games. The attack came after government officials urged residents at the start of the October 17th offensive to stay in their homes. Responsibility for the deaths has been disputed, as has the number killed. Lieutenant General, give me just a second. Lieutenant General Stephen Townsend. See if I can get this screen to stay. Let me leave it right there. The coalition has not released an estimated death toll. It is still investigating. I'm going to have to open this up in a new window, y'all, so I can read it. I'm trying to do it through our software for video streaming. Let me go ahead and pull that up. By the way, I do link to all of these articles in our program description, also in btrcommunity.com, which is our social media network. It goes on to say, Lieutenant General Stephen Townsend, the top U.S. general commanding the fight against Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, has said that there was at least a fair chance that the U.S.-led coalition was responsible for the strike, but if so, it was an unintentional accident of war, and we will transparently report it to you. Now, again, they admit that this was a residential area. That is in clear violation, bombing residential areas, bombing a nation's critical infrastructure, bombing hospitals is a violation. That's an international war crime. That's a violation of the Geneva Conventions. But I don't see Wolf Blitzer or anybody else making such a big deal about this. And again, I would submit to you, how many people, how many civilians have been killed by the United States since World War II and all of its act. Hell, we could just go back to the invasion of Iraq. It's been reported that it's about a million, and they still counting, obviously, because the United States is still there, but a million casualties since the invasion of Iraq by George Bush. Now, I haven't heard any numbers from the Gulf War, but I did have a top secret security clearance when I was stationed in Saudi Arabia during the Gulf War. And while that information may not have been declassified, let me just tell you, I saw the assessments of the bomb damage, the number of civilians that they estimated were killed, or the number of people estimated killed. And let me tell you, I would not be surprised if it ran in the tens of thousands. When George Bush, the Daddy Bush, George H.W. Bush, remember he was talking about we're going to bomb them for 40 days and 40 nights, playing on the Arabian fable or something, 40 days and 40 nights. I was like, man. So, you know, the United States is the last person to be pretending like it cares about civilians, because it does not. It has created more civilian deaths in this world than anybody else. All right, so let's go ahead and take a station identification break. You're listening to Black Talk Radio News on the Black Talk Radio Network. Black Talk Radio Network is managed by the North Carolina-based nonprofit Black Talk Media Project, and you can make a tax-deductible donation today if you would like to support the independent media that we produce. Okay, so we're going to take that break, and then we will be right back.
Talk Radio Network is made possible in part with help from the Black Talk Media Project, a North Carolina-based nonprofit engaged in the production and distribution of independent digital black media. Find out more by going to blacktalkradionetwork.com or blacktalkmediaproject.org and look for the menu tab, Crowdfunding Black Media. Black Talk Media Project, helping to provide you with new black media for the new millennium.
Tuned in to Black Talk Radio, new black media for the new millennium. And welcome back to Black Talk Radio News. Let me address a quick comment. Ms. Williams says, I don't think it's false about the elections and the Russians. Well, like Otis says, it's about the facts. It's not about what we believe. It's about what the facts say. And the fact is that they did not hack the elections. All right? Show me any article that says that somebody hacked the elections like we saw in 2000 with the first selection of George W. Bush and like they did in Ohio in 2004 with the electronic voting machines flipping votes. Nobody's alleging that happened. Okay? So, let's just say, for example, the Russians did hack the DNC servers. And they did release the emails that showed Hillary Clinton's campaign and the DNC colluded to cheat Bernie Sanders, that guy from Maryland, the former mayor and governor of Maryland. I can't recall his name right now. Okay. So that what you were saying is that you don't think, you know, you think that they did that? I mean, it really don't matter if they did or did not. How about this? If the DNC and Hillary Clinton weren't such unethical crooks, it would have been nothing to release to the public now, would it? And so people want to use that and say that, oh, the Russians meddled in the elections. Don't buy into that garbage when the United States right now is trying to overthrow a country and then overthrew a country in 2011 that had not been attacked the United States. And guess who's cheering on Donald Trump's unconstitutional action in attacking Syria? Hillary Clinton is. Oh, she's all for it. You know why? Because she's a warmongering skank. That's what she is. Okay, that's why. I hate that woman. I make it no secret. I hate Hillary Clinton. All right, she's a piece of human garbage. All the things she's done to the black community and calling black children super predators and then lying on people and calling for heads of states assassinations. Okay. And then she in her emails also say that they want to overthrow Syria for the benefit of Israel's security. But you want her, right? Okay. Whatever. Want to move to another article. This article right here is dealing with
what happened. Attorney General Jeff Sessions issued a statement Friday raising concerns over a consent decree imposing federal monitoring of the Baltimore Police Department. He said the decree has clear departures from many proven principles of good policing. The U.S. District Court for Maryland entered the decree to resolve the findings of the investigation of the Baltimore Police, which was started by the Civil Rights Division of President Obama's Department of Justice. The probe followed the death of Freddie Gray in April 2015. Gray's death in police custody sparked protests and riots in the city.
Okay, I made a mistake. I wasn't actually trying to play that. But it played anyway. But that was Jeff Sessions talking about how he was going to have the Justice Department review all of these police consent agreements that were signed during the Obama administration after the FBI and the Justice Department did investigations into these police departments, found all these constitutional violations. If you look at the Ferguson report, it even mentioned violations of federal law, even though it didn't name the statute, which I believe was the RICO Act, which they used to target organized crime and what have you. I believe that's what they were talking about in that Ferguson report when they mentioned federal statutes were violated. So Attorney General, as you just heard, Attorney General Jeff Sessions doesn't know much about how the police in Ferguson, Missouri treat black citizens. And this is an article from Cynthia Tucker. I have linked to that. It's a very good article. You should check it out. She said that he didn't bother to read the Justice Department report that found that Ferguson's municipal government has historically acted as if black residents were trespassers to be rousted and fined for petty offenses and jailed if they couldn't pay up. Sessions only read a summary of the report. He didn't read the Justice Department report on the Chicago Police Department. either, which cited frequent use of excessive force, largely aimed at black and brown citizens. The report also noted police supervisors rarely challenged officers who meted out the abuse. Sessions dismissed the findings as not scientifically based, even though, again, he read only the summary. I mean, what does this idiot mean by scientifically based? I mean, either they did it or they didn't do it. Either the evidence shows these things or it doesn't. What does he mean by scientifically based? Yet the attorney general knows enough to believe that law enforcement officials in Ferguson, Chicago, and Baltimore are the ones being mistreated. He seems poised to overturn several agreements negotiated by the Obama administration, agreements that mandated systemic changes in local police departments with a history of abusive conduct. She goes on, I'm going to close it out with this paragraph. It's an alarming turn of events. President Donald Trump's Justice Department is now poised to turn the agency's mission on its head. Instead of protecting those citizens who have endured violence at the hands of overzealous and, yes, racist police officers, the department will protect the police officers, allowing them to continue their brutality unchecked. The Department of Justice will not be standing up for justice. If Sessions cared about facts, he would have read the reports in their entirety. He would have noted the investigations were thorough and even-handed. If the Chicago report was largely anecdotal, that's because Chicago police were notoriously deficient in documenting their interaction with civilians. In Ferguson, for example, Obama's Justice Department exonerated Officer Darren Wilson, who shot 18-year-old Michael Brown. Brown's shooting, though apparently justified, helped to launch a painful national conversation about the relationship between law enforcement and citizens of color. The conversation was long overdue. All right, so this is what I think about it. I have not seen whereas these consent decrees actually make a difference. Okay, let's just be real about that. A number of these police departments have been under these federal monitors for quite some time, and it still doesn't seem to stop the abuse. It may lessen it some, as some officers be like, well, maybe, you know, I shouldn't do this since we got somebody overlooking us right now. But from what I can tell, they still continue with the same patterns and practice. So I'm not sure that these consent decrees, which are pretty much like non-prosecutorial agreements, for example, let me tell you what I'm talking about. For example, Wachovia, which was bought out by Wells Fargo some years ago, got busted laundering drug money. Over $1 billion in drug money they were laundering from the Mexican currency exchange houses. And rather than prosecute those involved, I don't care if it was the CEO or the chief financial officer or clerk, whoever was involved should have been prosecuted. But instead of these criminals being prosecuted, what happens to them? Oh, they just pay a fine and they enter into what's known as a deferred prosecution agreement. We won't prosecute you if you pay this fine and promise not to do it no more. But of course, the banks continue to do what they do and engage in all the criminal activities that they engaged in. So if you don't prosecute people, convict people, and then throw their butts in prison, where's the deterrent? And mind you that the fine in the Wachovia case did not even amount to the entire amount the U.S. government said they laundered in drug money. It was only a portion of it. So they still got to keep their drug money. I'll tell you, it's just crazy. So that is how I view these consent decrees that these police departments, these abusive police departments, enter into with the Justice Department. Now, with this guy, Jeff Beauregard Sessions, a Confederate, and I suspect him to be a racist, he's telling the police, y'all do whatever y'all want to do. We are not going to do anything to you. We are not here to uphold the Constitution and make sure that there's justice for all in this country. Just do what you do. And that's abuse citizens. You know, on New Abolitionist Radio, last Wednesday, we reported the article that $2.5 billion has been seized from American citizens through these asset forfeiture programs, law enforcement run, and these people hadn't even been convicted of crimes. Okay? So, and then he wants to talk about Baltimore. You know, Baltimore was the recent city or police department to enter into one of these consent decrees with the federal government. He tried to stop that, but the federal judge said, no, these are things that have already been agreed to by both sides, and he went ahead and he signed the agreement. And so now it's in full force in effect in Baltimore. But I bring up Baltimore because it was just not that long ago, about 2 or 3 weeks ago, where the Justice Department just indicted a whole bunch of Baltimore police officers for literally robbing people on the street, taking their money at gunpoint. I mean, and they were dealing drugs and then robbing the city for overtime that they didn't work. And this was supposed to be some kind of special gun task force. And the Justice Department just indicted a whole bunch of those cops. So now Jeff Sessions is telling you, oh, but we're not into the business of telling police and law enforcement how to do their jobs. He's not doing his job. That's part of their job. We got a caller from, looks like the 816 area code. Thank you for calling in to BTR News. Go ahead with your question or comment.
Hey, how's it going, Mr. Scotty Reed?
I'm doing the best I can behind these enemy lines. How about you?
I'm doing all right, brother.
So what's on your mind?
This is Sam out of KC. What's on my mind in particular? I'm getting some echoing. Do you know why it might be echoing on me?
No, okay, I don't.
Okay, I don't hear it anymore. Okay. All right. My question was, to your point there, I didn't mean to break your rant up, which you was getting to, but my question is, how do we find out the financial institutions that's backing some of these police unions?
That's backing? When you say backing police unions, what do you mean? I'm not sure.
Like funding them, providing the funding for them. Or is it like that?
No, it's not. It's not like that. Their funding comes from the taxpayers, not from the banks. But since you bring that up, and police are a part of 21st century slavery and human trafficking, you do have financial institutions that are underwriting the private prisons. Now, that we have been putting out information about the six big banks that, for example, underwrite the insurance for the private prisons like the GEO Group and Core Civic, formerly known as Correction Corporation of America. And without them underwriting their insurance, then those private prison plantations will be forced to go out of business. But I've never heard anything about financial institutions underwriting police departments. Now, I have heard about corporations partnering with the police and sponsoring, you know, different activities that police may be involved in, but in terms of funding them, that's all taxpayer funded.
Really?
Yes. Okay. And I will add, by those they robbing out there on the street through those asset forfeiture program,
which I have heard from former people affiliated with enforcement agencies, like mm-hmm. Homeland Security and things of that nature. I've heard of such stories, and guys from military, possibly even involved in some type of covert operations with some of these other clandestine parts of these governments. So I've heard of such things right there. And the reason, I don't know if you see my line of question there with the asking, because I'm just trying to better understand, okay, if these unions, you know, who's funding them? Okay, we're funding them. Then how, to get a better understanding, how then do we, like, hold them accountable? Because, you know.
Well, that's different what you asked.
That's the case then.
Now, when you say police unions, that's different than a police department. The police unions are private entities that aren't connected to the government, but they are made up. Well, how they fund themselves is from dues. Now, whether or not they're getting any kind of grants or corporate sponsorship, I really couldn't answer that for you. But the police unions are pretty much funded by the dues that the membership pays.
Okay, so when you were saying that initially, you were talking about the police departments are funded publicly.
Yes.
Okay, and you see why I asked you. My confusion was asking about the unions because of what you're talking about and them holding them accountable. Oftentimes, just as the public, we see that the police who are involved in these, or race soldiers who are involved in these infractions, they're normally, they're backed by the,
right.
States that they're backed by their police unions.
That's correct.
You get what I'm saying? You give them a train of thought I'm on.
Yes, you're right. You're totally right about that. And like my mother, for example, about maybe 15 years ago, she used to give to the local police benevolent association, but as she became more aware, and I'm not going to say like I live in an area where it's like Ferguson or Baltimore. Actually, we have very little interaction with police. But just as a point of principle, as she began to hear these stories, she was like, I can't give any more money to the police. So they will like do fundraisers. They'll hold like little events and stuff like that and sell tickets. But most of their money, I assume, comes from the membership dues. But you are exactly right. No matter what a cop does, you can have where we have had cops on video straight up murdering somebody. But here come the police union like they didn't do nothing wrong and providing them with attorneys and representation and things of that nature.
Right. And basically, that's basically why I've heard conversations before, because it seems like it's acting as some sort of arm of the system. And so I've heard conversations before is basically getting down to the nitty gritty of, okay, if we're constantly seeing this union be this, be that I won't say catalyst, but the power behind it, able to empower. Let's put it like that, better word, empower these race soldiers posing as police. Then we're better understood. Like, okay, where exactly are they getting their power from? Okay, who's providing this money? And so you're saying, okay, these are union dues that are coming out of the check, just like a regular other union that will be coming out of their check to provide for these type of services.
Right. Or they do little fundraisers.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Now, how do you attack that? You raise a very good issue. How do you attack that? Well, I would take a playbook out of the I would take a page out of conservatives' playbook. On the state level, on the state level, I would seek to have legislation passed outlawing police unions. Because we've seen that in the past, how they've made it illegal for like air traffic controllers to unionize. And we've seen this assault on unions from the so-called the right wing of the bird, because it's all one bird, two different wings, Democrats and Republicans or liberals and conservatives. But we've seen the right wing of the bird always try to weaken workers' unions and pass laws to make it hard to unionize. So I say use those same tactics to de-unionize the police.
Now, with that, Mr. Reed, then, sometimes you talk about your own county. I think it's Gaston County in North Carolina.
Yes.
A rural area. is that so small that it itself doesn't have a police union? In your own example, sir?
I've never heard of them having a police union.
Okay. Yeah.
Now, we got a lot of cities in this county, but not really cities, little towns. The only city we have in this county is Gastonia. That's the largest city in this county. The rest are just little small towns, and they have, like, their little small police departments that may have sometimes just three or four people working at them. But we have county police that serve the whole county. I've never heard of them having a union. So I'm not saying they don't. It's just I haven't looked into it, and I've never seen any kind of advertisement for that.
Mm-hmm. Which I can understand because, you know, coming out of Kansas City, Missouri, it's got a small, it's like a small town within a city type of concept, and it has little small towns around it. And so in those small towns, from what I've noticed, even just from my so-called white counterparts, they don't have a need for what you just said, for just like that. They don't have a need for some of these things because it's like a, it's so homogenous that it's almost like an understanding
mm-hmm.
in a way,
mm-hmm.
which for me was, is profound
mm-hmm.
because we don't, even in the regions where we're like a Baltimore, for example, great example of that, mm-hmm. even like a Baltimore where it is statistically, we have the greatest population there as far as ethnicities, right? But for some reason, we don't control, the black majority does not control apparatuses such as what we just talked, what we're talking about right now. You know what I mean?
Right, right.
We don't control them. And so for me, it's a, like Atlanta Black Star did a, they just wrote an article on that. How is this possible? You can have a black, you can have a black majority, a black mayor. I don't know if their police department is majority black, but I'm thinking, you know what I mean? You can have black federal judges around there, in and around there, and yet you have such inequities like that.
Well, are you, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Are you familiar with my term, proxy racism?
Yes, I am. Yes, I am.
Would you not think that explains it? Would you not think that explains what you're talking about? And you said Atlanta Black Star wrote about is proxy racism.
Yes, but it appears there is some type of, there's some type of more powerful apparatus in there. We could say the religion of white supremacy. We definitely could say that, but there is from a paperwork, from a money standpoint, there is some type of apparatus. That's a good example that there's some type of apparatus working in there to where it's keeping these people in check. To me, it would seem to
they're
me
gangs, man.
Keeping even.
They're gangs. If you look up Baltimore detective, what was that guy's name? Now, this was a white cop, a white detective.
Correct.
I think his name was Joe Glass or something like that. And he's not the only one. There's not a lot of them. I don't want to make it seem like there's a lot of whistleblowers coming forth. But he said when he saw two Baltimore cops beating up this handcuffed suspect, he told them to stop. Mm-hmm. He said, you know, said it was wrong. He reported them. And then,
right,
next thing you know, they start harassing him on the job, leaving dead rats on his windshield, harassing him, finding little stuff to write him up for. So it's just, it's like any other criminal organization, in my opinion. If you snitch, this is what happened to snitches. That's how they operate.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. And I think I've even heard an interview from him, but basically, Mr. Scotty Reed, I'm trying to find because Kansas City's not, it's not really made up like a Baltimore or whatever. I'm trying to find, not me, let me take that out of me. I know you're trying to find, and we're trying to find ways and solutions to help the people who need it the most.
Mm-hmm.
In a, you know what I'm saying? In a very simple way, because I'm one individual.
Right.
You dig what I'm saying? I'm one individual in Kansas City that happens to be in tune and listening to this and trying to figure out this problem right here. And it's specifically policing and what we're seeing now, what you just talked about with Jeff Sessions saying, hey, we're kind of going to turn our heads or turn our backs to the consent decrees, even though we know they were largely ineffective because they're doing what they want to do. So I'm just trying to find, some doggone tangible solutions that, you know what I'm saying?
You know, I did a podcast not that long ago. It's been over a month, though, where I first reported when he made these comments to a convention of state attorney generals, because, you know, each state got his own attorney general. And he was at a convention right when he first said this sort of stuff, that, oh, we're not going to be in the business of policing the police, and we're not going to tell them how to do their jobs. We're not going to spend money investigating them. And I said back then, he going to get a lot of people killed. Not only is he going to get citizens killed, but you're going to have some victims of the system who is going to take what's known as, what is it? What is the
compensatory?
Yeah, MECA. MECA, maximum emergency compensatory action.
Yes.
Like we saw in Baton Rouge, like we saw in Dallas. I mean, right, like we saw going back to the 60s during the Black Power Movement and before.
Right, right.
That's where I think it's going to head. Yeah.
And you to piggyback on that, I thought the same thing, Mr. Reed, when I heard you saying it, and for me it was resonating in me that, you know, they're trying to maintain or maintenance white supremacy right now. Seems like some fighting factions. But my concern was, if you continue to allow this contingency of race holders posing as police officers to continue to do this, and it's kind of like this kind of turn away from these white nationalists, right? Which we've seen a guy in Iowa shoot two cops. He executed two cops, mm-hmm. right? He was a white supremacist. He was at the football games agitating black folks, wearing Confederate flags. He ended up killing two white cops. And so he's not the only one. We know it was a rash of them, and it probably continues to be. They're just downplaying it. But to me, just like you were saying, I think it will end up, you know, crashing in on itself. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's sustainable. They keep finding these white nationalists who do not care, or let's call it what it is, extremists, right? White supremacist extremists, just out in Garner. So I don't know if you've seen it, Mr. Reed. I probably should have brought it up to you a couple months ago, but they stopped a group, some sect or some group of white group, right, militia group, who was planning on bombing a whole section of an apartment. Really, they probably was planning on bombing the apartment complex of refugees. We're talking about people from Somalia, and they got stopped. The FBI stopped it because they were trying to acquire major explosives. And so, to me, right there, and with those couple of instances that we mentioned, and maybe probably even in your home state, to me, I just was like, it's going to eat itself. But my concern in it eating itself is, just like what you're raising, what is it doing to the people who are on the lowest rung of this caste system, this white supremacist caste system they got going on? Because I don't want it, you know, just like what you're concerned, I don't want it to end up eating itself, and then we're, you know, irreversibly damaged, you know. So I that was my little rant at the end. I'm sorry about that, but just appreciate what you're doing, and, you know, I probably have to link up with you as far as email to figure out some doggone solutions to these things locally, you know what I mean, in our local politics or something, you know, because it's problematic, man. It's problematic.
Yes, and the solutions are going to have to come from the local level, from the grassroots, in my opinion. And some of those solutions, we may not, well, I'm not going to say may not, we should not be discussing publicly. And I'll leave it at that.
Correct, sir. All right. Go ahead and mute me, Mr. Reed. I appreciate you.
All right. Appreciate you calling in and sharing your thoughts. And actually, that's a good segue into the next article about the FBI has quietly been investigating white supremacist infiltration of law enforcement. But I do need to take a station identification break. This will be the last one. Got just a couple of more stories to get to. Do want to touch upon the school voucher or school bank account or something that Arizona has passed. There's a bit of confusion about exactly what they just passed, the governor signing the bill into law. And again, my thoughts on that, when we call the public school system the school-to-prison pipeline, when we talk about the statistics of black boys being disproportionately suspended for stuff that they shouldn't even be suspended for, but disproportionately suspended, when they're forcing our children through peer pressure or adults bullying our children to stand up for the slaver's flag and sing the slaver's anthem, why would you want to keep your children in public school if there is another option? Again, I'm not trying to say all public school systems are bad. I'm just trying to say, as it relates to black people and non-white people, we've been reading a whole lot of bad outcomes for us or for our children. So I don't see why non-white people would be opposed to such legislation. All right, you're listening to Black Talk Radio News. My name is Scotty Reed, broadcasting from behind the enemy lines of USA Inc. on the BlackTalkRadioNetwork.com platform. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Radio since 2008, providing new black media for the masses. And welcome back. Again, this is Scotty Reed in on this broadcast from behind the enemy lines of USA Inc. Seems like, okay, we don't have anybody else on the board. We got about a few more minutes left. Well, a couple of minutes left. I'm going to get through these stories before I close out. But now, I had wrote some time ago, it was sometime in 2016, I had either did a video or I talked about it on the broadcast. I may have even written about it. But the fact that you got these white supremacists who have infiltrated law enforcement and the federal government, the U.S. federal government knows about it. There was a 2006 report from the FBI on this, where they was even saying that you had nationally known high-ranking officials who had connections to these white supremacists, white nationalist organizations, but they redacted it. They didn't go arrest these people. They didn't try to expose them or nothing. As far as I know, they didn't do anything about it. So this article from The Intercept says that they have, the FBI has been once again investigating white supremacist infiltration of law enforcement. But again, Jeff Sessions just told all them white supremacists with badges and guns that, hey, y'all go out there and kill all the Negroes you want to. We don't care. We're not going to investigate. We're not going to look at what you're doing. We're not going to police the police. We're not about for justice for all. We are just about justice for us. That's basically what he's saying, is he not? So anyway, this article from The Intercept says white supremacists, let me pull, see if I can pull that up for you. may take a moment for it to load. Give me just a second. Again, this is from The Intercept. It says the FBI has quietly investigated white supremacist infiltration of law enforcement. Bureau policies have been crafted to take into account the active presence. Again, let me repeat that. The active presence of domestic extremists in U.S. police departments. Don't call them extremists. Call them what they are. Terrorists. These are terrorists. White supremacist terrorists. And like I said last week, for the first time possibly in U.S. history, a white person who practices the religion of white supremacy, who went to New York and attacked a black person for the first time probably in U.S. history, has been charged with an act of terrorism. But that was just by the Manhattan district attorney. The Justice Department, which is being run by a suspected white supremacist, Jeff Sessions, hasn't charged this guy with terrorism. But it is terrorism. What else is it? Okay, so this comes from The Intercept. Says white supremacists and other domestic extremists maintain an active presence in U.S. police departments and other law enforcement agencies. A striking reference to that conclusion, notable for its confidence in the policy prescriptions that accompany it, appears in a classified FBI counterterrorism policy guide from April 2015 obtained by The Intercept. Now, The Intercept didn't attain this till earlier this year, 2 years later. All right. The guide, which details the process by which the FBI enters individuals on a terrorism watch list, the known or suspected terrorist file, well, I'm glad they naming that, calling it terrorism, notes that domestic terrorism investigations focused on militia extremists, white supremacist extremists, and sovereign citizen extremists often have identified active links to law enforcement officers, and explains in some detail how bureau policies have been crafted to take this infiltration into account. Although these right-wing extremists have posed a growing threat for years, federal investigators have been reluctant to publicly address that threat or to point out that the movement's long-standing strategy of infiltrating the law enforcement community. Listen. The first police department was created in the 1600s during colonial times, and it was made up of recruits from the slave patrols. You know, I talked about Andrew Jackson last week and how he left this area, North Carolina, went to Tennessee. He was a poor cracker from Carolina. His family didn't have a pot to piss in, so he went to Tennessee and he joined the militia. What they're talking about is the slave patrols, okay? They weren't talking about no militia, you know, they training for the defense of America. No, it was to keep black folks in chains. And so this whole, when they start talking about this long-standing infiltration, I mean, they were founded by white supremacists. Come on. And they've always been connected to white supremacy. In fact, they are the enforcers of white supremacy. All right. I think we got, let me move on. No centralized recruitment process or set of national standards exists for the 18,000 law enforcement agencies in the United States, many of which have deep historical connections to racist ideologies. As a result, state and local police, as well as sheriff's departments, present ample opportunities for white supremacists and other right-wing extremists looking to expand their power base. Now, this is the report I was talking about, and I actually issued a report on, in a heavily redacted version of an October 2006 FBI internal intelligence assessment, the agency raised the alarm over white supremacist groups. Historical interest in infiltrating law enforcement communities or recruiting law enforcement personnel. The effort, the memo noted, can lead to investigative breaches and can jeopardize the safety of law enforcement sources or personnel. The memo also states that law enforcement had recently become aware of the term ghost skins, used among white supremacists to describe those who avoid overt displays of their beliefs to blend into society and covertly advance white supremacist causes, or just for the opportunity to kill a black person or to put one, or to frame one and put them into modern day slavery and human trafficking. So again, I don't have any confidence on white supremacists investigating themselves, and I'll just leave it at that. But I just, you know, wanted to make y'all aware of this. And another thing that goes along with this is they all in the U.S. military as well. They go to get that military training, plus the opportunity to go kill a non-white person somewhere, usually in the Middle East or Africa. Which Middle East is part of Africa, is really Northern Africa. But yeah, and they don't do anything about it. They're not trying to stop it. So, you know, maybe this is just lip service. I don't know. Maybe there are some people who are actually trying to address this problem. But, you know, I haven't seen anything concrete. I haven't seen a whole bunch of arrests or expulsions of these white supremacists. Now, I've seen a few arrests, but not a whole lot. And I know there are a whole lot of them. So that's from The Intercept. Now, the last thing that I want to share with you, this goes along with education. This goes along with education. Now, again, I have family members. My own sister is a school teacher. My cousin that lived next door is a school teacher. I got a cousin in Detroit, a professor. I know other people who are school teachers. I have nothing against teachers, okay? We need teachers, all right? But my issue with teachers is, especially black teachers, is when you teach the children white supremacist history and you're not teaching them real history or whatnot. So Arizona is not... it's not clear on if they passed the school voucher system or if they passed some kind of a voucher. Excuse me. Let me just pull up this article. Before I do that, I think we got a caller wants to comment. 816, did you want to comment again?
Yes, sir.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Reed, to the guests and everybody who's listening. I've known vets. It's interesting you brought that up. And maybe later on can correlate what's going on in these police departments. But I've known vets. Can you explain the phenomenon, you know, if they're going over there to possibly to, you know, I don't know, to kill non-whites, what is the, I guess my question is, let me try to gather this up. Why do they come back messed up then? Is it because it was too much? I mean, just speaking to a black vet, as it were, so-called black vet.
Now, I'm not saying all of them are white supremacists and they joining just to go kill non-white people, okay?
Correct.
Some of those people, man, when you see body parts and stuff like that, you know, when you see, like, for example, when I was in the Gulf War, I was in a mess tent one time. And they had some grunts in there. For those that don't know what grunts are, those are infantry soldiers. And 757, I'm going to mute you. I'll come to you right after this caller. I do see you on the board, so hang tight. They were showing each other pictures, passing around pictures of dead bodies. Like these were their souvenirs and stuff like that. Now, I don't suspect that those guys would come back messed up and broken up about what they saw. But some people who still have, a soul or a conscience or something, seeing that kind of constant death and destruction or always being in fear, knowing that, you know, it's a bullet out there with your name on it. I mean, it's a whole lot of stuff that goes into it and it can mess a person up. Psychologically. That's my only guess. I was not a combat soldier. I didn't see all that type of stuff. I was in communications, you know, technology and all of that. So I can't really speak to that. I do have some relatives who are Vietnam veterans, and they won't talk about it. They won't talk about it because,
yeah, I do too.
And I suspect it's because, you know, they don't like to see that kind of death and destruction of human beings, and it's affected them.
Think about it like that. Because we have one guy in my job, I think we all believe he's been affected by it, but he's trying to get back over there again. And
he's trying to get back over there.
Yeah, he's trying to get back over there, man.
In the military?
Like, yeah, do another tour of duty, I guess. So to speak.
What's his reasoning? Is he giving his reasoning?
Not really, but I suspect is what you're saying from his brown rhetoric, which is really black.
Okay.
You know, North African rhetoric. But it, to me, it's just concerning because he's got substance problems, or he's recovering, and you know, damn near his family's damn near split apart because of it, and he's, you know, he wants to get back over there. And it's just, to me, it's just, I don't know. I guess you're not, it's irrational. White supremacy, I guess. I'm trying to rationalize white supremacy.
Yeah, it's not rational.
And it's not rational.
They just, they barbarians, man. They sick, psycho, sociopathic people. These the same people that you know, made a sport out of terrorizing and mutilating the bodies of black people. So, it you know, that's their mentality every day. So if they go off to war and they see that type of stuff, I don't suspect it will affect them in the same way it would affect a human being.
Now, to that point, I know you spoke on Syria somewhat, and I didn't get a chance to hear the beginning. I've heard commentators, other so-called black commentators, speak on it. Would you view Syria as a non-white nation? Or I don't know, when I look at Assad and some of those people, I would assume they may not be, to the Anglo, they may not be classified as white, but I think there's some unconscious things that, I don't know, would you call that a non-black nation? I mean, a non-white nation, or
I don't know. Assad looks white, but you know, there's different levels of melanation even among non-white people. But those Arabs, when we're talking about Arabs again, if they have not, you know, been dominated by that African gene and they're purely Arabs, well, aren't they classified as white when they come here to the United States?
That's what I was thinking, and so it would explain some level of autonomy that he's had and that country's had over, I don't know, it's probably been decades,
yeah,
period of time, but in that area.
Yeah, but what's
so go ahead.
Well, what that's really about is what most of the war is about, resources. Lots of strategic oil and gas in Syria and pipelines in Syria. So, you know, that's why the United States and these Western white supremacist nations are interested in that country. But if you ask the white supremacist, let's say we asked a Ku Klux Klan member, he probably wouldn't accept Assad as white. I don't know.
Right.
You know,
I don't know if you call truth to the game white supremacist. I'm using similes and analogies. I should be a little bit more clear, but I don't know. I was listening to News and Brutal Truth from the brother who does In Cobra.
Yeah.
And I don't know. And I've heard some other commentators speak on it, but everything around that situation, I don't know. It's very weird. It's like Turkey. When I look at the president of Turkey and those people over there, they have a lot less knowing. I wouldn't be able to tell. If they say my name is Hank Johnson, I wouldn't be able to tell. I would think he's just like some other so-called white person here in America. So I just wonder, does that, does that go into the larger psychological thing of, okay, these resources, we'll let you have power. Whereas you were talking about with Gaddafi, which he's a lighter-skinned Arab or whatever, you speak on him quite a bit, you and brother Dave from Tando, you know, the level of, but his country, you know what I mean? You look at Libyans, we see the pictures of Libyans, those people are quite a bit darker. You know, they have some light people in there, but they're quite a bit heavily melanated. Mm-hmm. And we see what happened to them. You know, the Western powers took swift action mm-hmm. and deposed him. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Again, Saddam Hussein, he's a little bit more melanated. But they took, we know he's propped up. We know he was propped up, like a lot of these people are, but took swift, decisive action. Very swift, decisive action. Yeah.
But when I look at Syria, and I do need to move on to the next caller, but when I look at Syria, I look at it like Mr. Fuller said, is it justice or non-justice? And I try not to be confused by people's skin color. Is this at practicing justice or is this practicing injustice? And I see what the United States and Britain and these other countries are doing to Syria as an act of injustice in the furtherance of white supremacy.
Thank you, Mr. Reed. I appreciate it, man. Thank you.
You're welcome. Area code 757, thanks for being patient and hanging in there. Go ahead with your question or comment.
Oh, hello, Scotty. It's Griffin again.
Hey, what's up, Otis?
Yeah, not a whole lot. Oh, I was going to touch lightly on what the gentleman was just talking about. It's not all just skin color in the Middle East. It's geopolitics and resource acquisition. The subject you were getting ready to come on to now when you're talking about school vouchers, the only thing I was going to say prior to you getting into it is I intended to send you a few articles because I was a single dad for the last 15 years. And what's happening with vouchers is just like you're talking about Arizona, because I happen to know a little bit about what's going on there. The conservatives have really cornered that state. They own the testing. They own all the evaluation and printing companies.
Mm-hmm.
Not only that, the way they're writing their laws to use vouchers, they've done this very same thing basically you do with gerrymandering. They're taking people that are going to public schools, and actually they're only going to end up getting about 75 or 80 cents on a dollar compared to if you live in a zip code with a higher income. So what's happening is you got people. When you set up these, like Tucson's only a city that's about 15 or 16 square miles wide. But you set up charter schools so a parent without the income can't even afford to drive their kid to, quote, a school of choice. So with computers have made it now, so everything is rigged. A parent who's making $200,000, $300,000 a year, there's no problem. They get chartered vans and all kinds of stuff. Or they have the income that the schools can defray the additional cost. And I'll send you a couple articles because I ended up having to catch up with this lady named Diane Revitz to help me with my child when I was here in York County. So I'm going to let you talk on the vouchers, but I'm going to tell you, the fine print behind the vouchers is what's killing minorities.
Hold on a second, though, Otis. Don't hang up yet. Let me just share a little bit from this article from WashingtonExaminer.com about what's going on in Arizona. It says the Associated Press reports Friday morning that Arizona's Republican Governor Doug Ducey signed a major school voucher expansion bill. In reality, the bill did not expand school vouchers, which are unconstitutional in Arizona, but it did expand education savings account. An even bigger leap forward for school choice. This is the article that was written by Jason Russell. He says, education savings accounts give families even more flexibility than school vouchers do. With vouchers, a family simply takes their government-issued voucher and can only use it for private school tuition. With education savings accounts, families get a special education bank account kind of like an education version of a health savings account. That's what I was saying at the beginning of the show. That's what it reminded me of. They can use the account for expenses, including private school tuition, tutoring, educational therapy, and textbooks. The accounts would have at least 90% of the students per pupil funding distributed into it. Parents have the freedom to spend those dollars on any educational expense, can roll the funds over from year to year, although the Arizona accounts now can't be rolled over into a college savings account. Four other states have education savings accounts, but only for students with special needs or for low-income students assigned to failing public schools. This is what my question is, because I said I'm mixed on this. I have mixed views on this, Otis, because we keep reporting about the school to prison pipeline. We keep reporting about these black boys being targeted for these psychotropic drugs, and then suspending them all the time, which builds up a record that prepares them for prison and what have you. So my thing is why would the black community be against this? Because if I was in an area where that kind of stuff was going on, I would definitely want to take my education dollars for my child and homeschool them. Your thoughts?
Well, that's kind of what I'm saying. If they're going to let you work an account where you're, if not based on your income, then it makes sense to me that it'll work. What I'm saying to you is these reporters are reporting this thing as though it's just a nice scenario where you have X amount of dollars. But the thing is, with a charter school, there is no control over, quote, teachers. They hire instructors. Most of them have 6 to 8 weeks of training. They don't even have to be certified in the subject that they teach, because everything is based on the printed and bubble test, electronic test. So what ends up happening is, if you're a person that's only making $25,000 to $35,000 a year, how do you set up a $15,000 account? See, they keep saying they're giving you a savings account, but that account is, you got to go to the bank and establish this account. Then you got to show receipts for paying it out. If you make $150,000, $200,000 a year, husband and wife making quarter million dollars a year, which is, believe it or not, the average income for white folks is of total wealth is somewhere in $100,000 to $120,000 a year. The average for black people across this country is somewhere around $35,000 to maybe $40,000 a year.
Okay.
Usually, if you're under 40, you're in student debt of something like $11,000 to $12,000. So you don't even have the $15,000 to put into the account to initiate this thing.
Well, what I'm getting from this particular bill in Arizona is that there's a certain amount of money that the public school system gets for a child, all right? And that with these accounts, you would get at least 90% of what they would have gave to a school. And it's saying, again, based off of this article, I would have to go and read the statute and do more research. But based off of this article, it's saying the parents had the freedom to spend those dollars on any educational expense.
Hey, and what I'm saying to you is, the way it works, I'll send you some links because I've been on it for a while.
Okay.
You get the tax credit, but it is not exactly how it sounds because of the wording. They don't send you money. They give you a limit based on what they do. In other words, like in Tucson, if they're spending, I just finished reading one of the articles, if they're spending somewhere around $22,000 in your particular zip code, then you might end up getting an $18,000 credit, which means if you spend that $18,000 and show receipts for it for a year, then that comes off your taxes. Understand what I'm saying? You're not getting $18,000 put into a bank account.
Yeah, that's the way they make it sound in this article, though, is like you will. He says four other states have education savings accounts. That will make you think that, you know, there's a special account at the bank that we're going to set up, and we might give you a debit card just like they do with the EBT cards, and then you could just charge your expenses to that card. I don't know. Right. Definitely worth investigating more.
Right. That's what I'm getting ready to say. That's why I was saying to you, because I happened to, we were talking about it a couple of weeks ago when it came up, and I just happened to be on a feed with this lady named Diane Rebish that's been doing this across the nation for like 15, 16 years. Mm-hmm. That's why I started digging into it. As a matter of fact, I'll send you a good article on it where they start dissecting it, because they found out the man who actually proposed it, and then they had the governor end up tweaking it, because what ended up happening is the senator who actually put it before the Arizona House, he ended up not revealing the fact that he was actually part owner of the testing company that gets to, and the company that's going to run the voucher program. So it was a big stink with that. That's why the Arizona governor ended up switching this from, quote, straight out voucher, where you could get 80% or 20% of your money. In other words, had to be sent right to the academy. If you enrolled your child in a school, the money of the voucher would be sent straight to that school. That's initially how they started out. Now that they found out that he lied about it to try to keep the lawsuit from going forward, they've tweaked this thing now where you can set up an account. I'll send you the information. That's now, what I keep saying. I learned this early on. When you deal with white folks, the details matter.
Yeah, certainly the details matter. But Otis, what we going to do, though, about the school-to-prison pipeline? What we going to do about these suspensions? Why do we want to keep sending our children to schools that's indoctrinating them into white supremacy?
Well, I see that the same way I see the 13th Amendment. We need to educate these primarily black parents to understand. Police need to come out of these schools. You need to go back to when you talk about local laws, you need to be on your local representatives about criminalizing teenage and adolescent behavior. That's what's happened over the last 15 to 20 years. I just happened to get my child right at the time, like 15 years ago. He was 7 years old. He's now 24. So that's like 15, 16 years ago. I just happened to, you know, being a single dad, you go up to PTA meetings and I'm finding out, I look after school and I see this room full of 25 or 30 black kids. And they're all male, and it's after school detention. I start asking questions. Wow, how come all of these guys are in there? Well, you know what the principal had the nerve to tell me? I mean, I learned it face up. He said, well, 80% of my teachers are white females. They're afraid of them.
Wow.
I said, then don't you think you need some training, some sensitivity training or something? Well, we don't have the funds for that. Typical, you know how it goes. We can't afford it. I said, so you're telling me it's okay to wreck these kids' lives. I mean, and that's, to make a long story short, that's when they started calling me a helicopter dad, because I started spending my time there. Fortunately, I was self-employed. It cut back on my efficiency. But I told them, if I'm 40 years old and I got a 7-year-old child, I'm 47 and I got a 6 or 7-year-old child, I've worked enough that I can put some effort into this job, because that's the only life I'm responsible for raising. And I'm telling you, I saw it. I go sit in his classroom. I watch white female teachers with mixed classes. I understood the psychological effect that these teachers had on students. Watch a child raise their hand, and the teacher look right at him, ignore him, and call somebody sitting behind him. And then when the next question comes up and that kid's head is down and they don't put their hand up, they call him and embarrass him. Because, you know, they realize that's the area I don't know. And I started being proactive then, getting in the PTA saying, look, there's psychological damage going on here. You know exactly what you're doing. I mean, to the point when the principal started telling me I had to sign in when I come into school, I literally went on the website and printed out exactly what the advertisement was, because I come from an area that they advertise about being safe neighborhoods. It's kind of rural, but it's got decent schools. Yorktown, Virginia. I said, hey, you're on your website talking about free and open door policy. How the hell are you going to tell me I'm born and raised here? You can't tell me about no signing in. So, I mean, I literally went through the whole police thing and all of that. If you change the rules for everybody, then I'm going to abide by them. If not, lock me up. I'm 50 years old with a 10-year-old child. What the hell I worry about you talking about locking me up? So I'm telling you, I was upset, and I know some teachers, I'm upset with black professionals that won't stand up for what they know is going on in those schools.
Right.
Literally demoralizing children based on their fear. You know how that works.
Right. Well, Otis, I want to thank you for sharing that, man, and send me those links. And it's a topic that we will revisit because we got to do something, man. We got the school to prison pipeline. Then, you know, we got this issue with the vouchers. I mean, it's just so much, man. It's very difficult for black parents in this environment. But thank you for your call, Otis.
Hey, can I sneak in one more thing before you give up?
Yeah.
Max has been hitting on this state convention thing. We need to make people aware of that because if we don't, the Koch brothers are going to change laws all over this land where our children won't even have the options that we had.
Right, yeah. We do definitely need to stay abreast of that. Right now it's at 10 states. For those listeners who don't know what Otis is talking about, Alec, the Koch brothers, conservatives are trying to put together a constitutional convention. You had to have 3/4 of the states agree to it, and this is when they can then go in and remake the Constitution. And so definitely something to be aware of. All right, Otis, thanks, man.
All right, be strong, Scott. I'm proud of you, man.
Thank you. All right, so we're going to get ready to wrap it up. Thank you for tuning in to BTR News. Remember to support independent media. There's a huge assault on independent media. The mainstream media is threatened by us, and therefore they're trying to prevent the different ways that we try to fund the work that we do. Now, the Black Talk Media Project is a U.S.-based nonprofit. Therefore, the donations are tax deductible. All right. So please go to blacktalkmediaproject.org and make a donation today or pick up one of the Black Radio Stations Matters T-shirts. Okay. All right. So recognize the fact that we live behind the enemy lines of USA Inc. It's a battlefield out there, casualties being created every day. This nation never stopped practicing slavery. Slavery has been constitutionalized in the 13th Amendment, and we need abolitionists in order to bring an end to modern day slavery and human trafficking. All right. But we can affect that change if we are out here becoming casualties on the battlefield. So just do all you can to become codified and learn how to move behind these enemy lines without attracting too much attention to yourself, but do as much damage as you possibly can. With that said, I'll be back on air later this week. Peace and blessings to all.